Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. In each episode of these podcasts, we examine a key theme driving our world. With access to the world's leading experts, we explore the past, present, and future. I'm Adam Bolton, and in this episode, we're going to talk about the book. During the lockdowns of 2020 and 2021, almost all industries shrunk overnight. There were some clear exceptions, which enjoyed record sales. Leisureware, computer games, air fryers, and also a much older technology, books. Their sale had been in steady decline for decades. But as millions became confined to their homes, with time to spare, the publishing industry enjoyed a boom in profits. It now seems that that boom was short-lived. Sales have come down again with a thud, begging the question, is there a place for books in our digital future? This episode, I'm going to discuss that with Professor Emma Smith of the University of Oxford. First, though, we need to go back to when the book, as we know it, was a revolutionary new invention. With me to discuss that is Professor Alexander Lee of the University of Warwick. He began by explaining what came before the book.
You have to begin with the first written records, which extend back way into prehistory, sort of 3,000-4,000 years BC. Very, very simple texts, gradually getting longer and more complicated. And there's a greater interest in permanence and greater complexity in the information that people want to keep.
And these were basically recorded on natural objects, wood and stone and clay and things like that.
Absolutely, that's right. Obviously, when any new technology begins, it starts with the material that people have to hand. So we do have a large number of clay tablets. The early records of texts like Linear A and Linear B are impressions in clay or things like that. And then later you have for Egyptians, Egyptian hieroglyphics are written on papyrus and things like that, made from reeds that are that grow on the banks of the Nile, etc. And as time goes on, however, you see greater ambition and great confidence coming into the use of the technology and more material being brought into play, so skins being prepared and eventually pointing on towards the production of the first papers.
And when we talk about the early libraries, I suppose the great library that was lost at Alexandria is the most famous one. They weren't repositories of books, were they?
Not in the sense that we know, a book folded down the middle with a spine and lots of pages you can flick through. No, not at all. Generally, they are repositories of text preserved in other forms.
Scrolls in particular, would it be?
Particularly, yes.
The big sort of technological breakthrough came out of what we'd now call Germany, would it?
That's absolutely right. By the late 14th century, early 15th century, there's already some sense that something needs to give to accelerate this process. So we have some indications that a few people were perhaps beginning to experiment with block printing. You'd take a block of wood and you would literally carve in mirror image the text that you wanted to reproduce, or one page of the text you wanted to reproduce. The problem is, of course, that this takes a lot of time and is quite a fragile material. But the big shift then occurs in around 1450 in Mainz. And it's made by a guy called Johannes Gutenberg. And what he does is he develops a movable type, which involves preparing small, very narrow little metal bars, each of which bears a raised impression of a single letter. And he prepared a fount of type with all the letters that you could possibly want, combined with a new machine, the printing press, which was based on wine presses, of which there are a lot in Mainz. With the printing press, a new, more viscous type of ink, which is really a varnish, and the increased use of paper in preference to vellum. This allowed Gutenberg to produce any text in effectively any numbers relatively quickly and, by comparison, at a lower kind of cost, without any significant loss of clarity.
And what did he produce? Was this primarily something driven by religion, religious fervour?
Well, absolutely right. When we kind of think about the printing revolution, I suppose many of us are inclined to believe that it was instinctively inclined to suppose that it was a kind of secular evolution. But actually, that's not true. The first book that Gutenberg produces is his famous Bible, 42-line Bible. And there's some evidence to suggest that it was designed to meet predominantly the needs of religious communities. Although several copies do find their ways into private hands, this is directed towards religious purposes. And this first book is still quite expensive. By some estimates, the 42-line Bible cost about three times the annual wage of your average worker. So it's still pricey.
And when you say 42 lines, that's how many lines there were on a page, is it?
That's absolutely
right. How many pages are there in a Gutenberg Bible?
I would have to check that. I have to confess I don't have that number exactly.
It was Old and New Testament, was it?
It is a complete Bible.
In which language?
It's a complete Latin Bible.
Right, so it's not putting the biblical text into the language of the communities which it's going to.
It is not an attempt at this stage to offer a vernacular translation now. Although quite soon afterwards, vernacular texts do begin to be produced, and secular texts as well. Don't forget the first book that is printed by William Caxton in England at his press in Westminster in 1476 is an edition of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
I was going to ask you about what Caxton's role in that. He basically brought, Gutenberg's technology to Britain, was that?
That's absolutely right. One of the remarkable things about printing is that very soon after Gutenberg develops the first printed book, it causes a sensation. People are amazed at the clarity of his text. The future Pope Pius II says, "This is amazing, I can read it without using my glasses." And people very quickly want to emulate it. Within 30-odd years, it spread across Europe, predominantly by German printers who are keen to set up their own presses or who are invited to do so by local potentates. Caxton is a slight exception in that he was an Englishman and learnt his trade in Cologne and Bruges and then brought it back to England. So he's one of the very few of these early days who isn't of German origins.
And obviously the availability of these texts in whatever language, whether in the vernacular or in Latin, it was to some extent, was it a democratisation of knowledge and information?
Well, that's a really good point. Many of the earliest responses to printing that we have do emphasise exactly this. About 18 years after Gutenberg's text makes its appearance, a bishop called Giovanni de Bussi says that printing is a holy art that makes texts available to even the poorest people for the first time. By this stage, of course, there's been a move away from producing these massive, very impressive books like the 42-line Bible of Gutenberg and towards cheaper, more affordable works. And there is this feeling that as they become cheaper, it's possible for even people of more limited means to start building up their own libraries, which they do. And there is this expectation that as more people buy books, obviously they'll read more, they'll learn more, and, you know, there's this hope that we'll enter a new age of learning, of education, of enlightenment, if you like.
And what about the level of literacy? How many people could actually take advantage of the print in these books?
Printing is only really needed because there is a generally high level of literacy. To give you some kind of indication, one of the most famous illustrations of this comes from Florence in the late 14th, early 15th centuries. It's estimated that at about this time, you have a literacy rate of, you know, pushing 80% of the adult male population, which is a level which was not reproduced until the 19th century. You have at this time as well, across Europe, an explosion of education, increasingly secular education. So more people are able to read and more people want to read as well. And when printing comes along, they obviously seize the opportunity.
And was there any backlash against the print, the democratisation, if you like, of information and knowledge?
Well, absolutely. Just because a lot of people celebrated printing as a force for the democratisation of knowledge, it doesn't mean that everybody was. There were many people who were bitterly opposed to it. Perhaps the best known and the most vehement was a chap called Filippo di Strada, who lived in Venice. He was originally from Pavia, but he lived in Venice on the island of Murano. And he wrote a few extremely bitter screeds against printing. He was a very miserable man anyway, but he had a particular animus against printing. He disliked printers. He said they were like baboons. They were lazy, drunk thieves. But he particularly disliked the effect that printing would have on learning. And he wasn't entirely unjustified in this, because when printing begins, there's an intense competition between printers to churn out the kind of text that they think people might like. And that, of course, led to an emphasis on speed. One might think of Facebook in its early days, that their motto, move fast and break things. And things did break in early printing. Lots of mistakes crept into early editions of classical texts, particularly just because not every printer had the time to check their print, and not every printer had the wherewithal or the means to employ trained scholars to check the proofs of the work they were producing. So, for example, you have a Florentine chap called Niccolò Perotti, who's so upset with the quality of works that is being produced in the late 15th century that he says that many of these books should never have been printed at all. And this leads Filippo di Strada to say that if lots of people of relatively modest means are buying books full of errors, what you're going to see is not an improvement of knowledge, but a degradation in the quality of learning.
What did Machiavelli, your subject of your book, what did he think about the rise of print?
Well, Machiavelli has very mixed experiences of print. It's remarkable that very rarely experiments with print. Most of his best-known works only make it into print after his death. His first experiment with printing, if you like, his first experiment with it, was terrible, absolutely terrible. He wrote a poem in the early 16th century called the Decennale Primo, and this is a verse history of Florence in a 10-year period between 1494 and 1504. It's designed to illustrate Florence's need to arm itself for war and to get ready for a big fight. And he thinks this is important enough that it should be printed and it should be circulated amongst the great and the good. So he goes out and has a lovely little edition printed with these, probably the financial support of one of his colleagues, Agostino Vespucci. The problem is that after it's been printed, and Machiavelli sent a few advanced copies out to his acquaintances and friends and goes off into the countryside to start recruiting soldiers, Vespucci finds that somebody has produced a bootleg version. This kind of thing happened quite a lot. Either, you know, rival printers would buy a copy of a text and then rush out their own versions, or they would even pay people to steal proofs or sheets as they were drying and then rush out their own versions before the original could even be sold. In Machiavelli's case, Vespucci was horrified. He said, this is terrible. There's lots of mistakes. The margins are awful. The type is rotten. And we've got to sort this out. So they go and complain to the authorities. But the problem is, there's no copyright protection at this stage. So, you know, how do you protect your interests if you don't have copyright and you don't have any other kind of privileges on which to fall back? And so they have to try and cast the bootleg version as effectively a kind of libel, which is very uncomfortable and awkward, but it does the job. So all the bootleg versions are withdrawn from sale. So Machiavelli and his backup are quite happy. But then Machiavelli thinks to himself, hold on a minute, somebody else is going to do this. So why don't I just work with this guy who's bootlegged my book and produce a better version, which effectively cuts his old financial backer and friend, Vespucci, out of the equation, with resulting, we imagine, loss of income. So he has a very bad experience and he doesn't experiment with print again for a long time. He got his fingers burned quite badly and he wasn't the only one.
And of course, with the Renaissance, with the arrival of the book, we also had fairly quickly the arrival of book burning.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. If we just go back to Filippo di Strada, Filippo di Strada, of course, said, as we've already mentioned, that there was a concern that the availability of more and more religious books of a defective nature would lead to sin and heresy. Now, that wasn't necessarily true. It's very hard to judge, but it's certainly true that the invention of printing did lead to heterodoxy. And it made available Christian texts which diverged significantly from the teachings of the Catholic Church. Printing is one of the principal reasons why the Lutheran Reformation gathers pace so quickly. Soon after Luther's 95 theses are nailed on the door of Wittenberg Cathedral, they are rushed into print by loads of people and disseminated as widely as you can imagine. And, of course, the more that heterodox views become disseminated, the more concern there is about them, and the more of an issue the Reformation becomes, the greater there is a desire to control access to books which one might not want to be circulated. This also plays out in a non-Christian setting as well. It's notable that particularly in Venice, you see the growth of Hebrew printing for Jewish audiences. And this has great success. A chap called Daniel Bomberg in Venice leads the way in Venetian printing of Hebrew books. Unfortunately, the availability of Jewish texts again arouses the ire of the Catholic Church, which fears that the availability of the Talmud, for example, will erode the integrity of Catholicism and seduce Christians into renouncing their faith. And so there are famous instances of Talmud being publicly burnt in the streets of Rome. And it plays in other contexts too. You have licentious works being destroyed, etc., etc. The more divergent views or diverse views or heterodox views are available, the greater the impulse to react strongly against them and violently against them.
And this was also manifested by Savonarola and presumably the Inquisition as well.
Well, Savonarola, again, is a very good case. He's a Dominican friar who rises to prominence in France shortly after the expulsion of the Medici in 1494. And in 1498, at the peak of his powers, he organises two of these great bonfires, the Vanities, on which a whole bunch of stuff that he regards as harmful to public morality are burnt. And that includes works of art, it includes makeup, mirrors, racy clothing, and of course, crucially, books. Books that he regards as leading people into error and sin. And it's difficult to identify which ones were on there because our accounts of the bonfires of vanities are incomplete. But it probably included works like Boccaccio's Decameron and secular poetry.
And to what extent would you say, from your perspective, that the Reformation was, to a certain extent, a struggle over the control of the printing press, the Catholic Church wanting to maintain control of what was printed?
Well, it is certainly true that, as I said earlier, the Reformation would not have spread so far, so fast, were it not for printing. It's as much a printing revolution as it is a religious revolution. We've already mentioned the dissemination of Luther's 95 Theses, but it is equally true that in the years that follow, you see the production of a great number of fly leaves that are satirical or vituperative or invective, in Germany directed against the Pope and the Catholic Church, etc., etc. These certainly make available to a wider audience the ideas of Luther and his allies.
And, of course, in the UK, we had the struggles over the vernacular Bibles.
Well, absolutely. The struggle over the dissemination of religious ideas that are heterodox is always a source of stress and conflict. It is a moot point whether, had it been possible to control the printing presses in Germany more forcefully, the Reformation would not have been such a problem. I mean, that's the counterfactual that we can't answer. But what we can say is that because there was no way or no awareness of the need to control the production of printed materials in Germany in the early 16th century, it is because of that that Lutheranism spread dramatically, and you see the path that laid towards the later wars of religion in Germany and in France and elsewhere laid out.
But effectively, would you say that by the early 1600s, really the book had won, that there was now an organised technology across Europe, effectively?
People like Filippo de Strada are very, 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 very deeply opposed to printing because of its inherent, the flaws that are inherent in the process and in the competition that it generates. And he's not alone. There are plenty of other people criticising printing. But there's no systematic effort to do away with printing full stop. There is nobody sort of saying, right, let's absolutely, definitely stop printing now. There's no discussion that I'm aware of, at least in Rome, for example, of shunning printing because it's so dangerous. Nobody's saying, right, we will, you know, forbid our clerics from having anything printed. We will no longer use printed Bibles. We don't want any books of ours to be printed. Nobody is saying that at all. In fact, you see the dissemination of religious texts, both Catholic and of Lutheran or Reformed or whatever, Calvinist, etc., only expands over time, and that they're read by ordinary people often on a daily basis. So, yeah, printing had won by that stage, but it had also won almost as soon as it had appeared. The inherent benefits of it were so great that for most people, they massively outweighed its downsides. Now, whether we can, you know, many of the arguments that are made for and against printing in this period may be reminiscent of some of the discussions that we have had in recent years about the internet and things like Twitter, etc. But again, just as today, there was no possibility of going back. So there was no going back with printing.
And moving on from your period, what would you regard as the subsequent post-Renaissance sort of staging posts in the development of the book?
Well, now you're taking me very much outside my province. However, I think in a sense it's, maybe I can answer it in a slightly different way. To ask what are the staging posts after the early modern period is in a sense a false question, because the genie is already out of the bottle by the time you reach 1600. After that point, the book has assumed essentially its authoritative form. And everything that comes after is designed to merely accelerate the process. Even forms of technology that have appeared quite recently, like Kindle readers or the internet, preserve, as far as is possible, the same format that we've been using since Gutenberg's 42-line Bible appeared. If you have like a Kindle reader or one of those little things, you know, you turn the page in much the same way as you would. We still speak of pages. You know, things like bookmarks are used in a different way. The same kind of ideas are preserved. All that we're doing is making it quicker, more accessible and better.
Professor Alexander Lee of Warwick University there. Well, joining me now is Emma Smith. She's a fellow and lecturer in English at Hertford College, Oxford. She's also a fellow librarian and archivist and curator of the Sensational Books exhibition at the Bodleian Library. The exhibition considers how people experience books physically. And Emma Smith is also the author of Portable Magic, The History of Books and Their Readers. And can we perhaps start with that phrase, portable magic? What does it mean in terms of books?
Well, it's a wonderful phrase, isn't it? It comes actually from Stephen King, the horror writer, his memoir On Writing, which I really recommend to anybody who's struggling to write their novel. But he just, it's a throwaway remark, really. He talks about books as a kind of portable magic. And I really hooked on to that. The portability is obvious, but the magic is so interesting because, as we all know, there's a bright and cheerful and wonderful and sort of permissive side to magic, but there's also perhaps a darker side. And I was interested in whether books are sometimes books of spells, you know, books that make things happen in the world, and sometimes those things are good and sometimes less so.
For thousands of years, there's been writing of some kinds and attempts to record writing. When did books, if you like, acquire this sort of talismanic effect?
I think most scholars who know lots more about this than I do would put the development of the book, the early books are called codices, the codex, they would put that more or less at the same time as the development of Christianity, and that's not coincidental. It does seem as if the book, as opposed to the scroll, develops as a particular technology to communicate Christian scriptures, and that may be because the Christian Bible is all about sort of going backwards and forwards and not reading in a linear way and having, you know, maybe two or three pages open at the same time. Very, very hard to do that with a scroll, but a book makes that very easy. We're all used to doing that every day. So kind of 2,000 years or so, we start to see the first books, and then they move to be containers and conveyors of all kinds of other material. So the first books were Bibles, and we still keep that sense in the word bibliography or bibliophile or bibliothèque in French.
The word biblos means book in Greek.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the real democratisation, if you like, and the spreading of that magic, is that linked to the arrival of printing?
So definitely the arrival of print from the Far East, where it was well established, into Europe, and we usually put Gutenberg as the sort of inventor or the instigator of print in Europe in the middle of the 15th century, that does change everything, although quite slowly. So Gutenberg's Bibles that he famously produces in Mainz in Germany in the 1450s, probably takes about 2 years to produce the run of Bibles, 170 or so Bibles. So It's not like pressing a button and you suddenly get loads and loads of copies and that they're very cheap. The first printed books are still quite elite, quite expensive books, but that technology rapidly spreads and makes books more accessible and makes ideas more accessible. And then we get another really important step, I think, in making books available to a really large population. Actually, as recently as the Second World War, when paperbacks and paperbacking become popular, and that transforms the book market in the later 20th century in ways that we're all now familiar with. And it makes books within the sort of price bracket of probably a majority of people, certainly in the global north.
I mean, I'm interested in that because, of course, the period of mass literacy with the novel, you know, people always point to Dickens and things, that precedes paperbacks, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right. And there's a reason that those novels, those big Victorian novels, are published in serial form. And that's partly about a kind of payment spread. You know, it's making them cheaper, making each part cheaper, because the book itself is quite an expensive thing for many people to invest in. So I think what changes with the paperback is that the book as an object becomes relatively, and I think probably in actual terms, just cheaper, just more available. So certainly mass literacy in the 19th century completely transforms readership. It's the movement which gives us public lending libraries and all kinds of other features of the book world. But maybe it's not a coincidence that both serialization and the lending library suggest that buying a whole book is beyond the means of many people who can nevertheless read one.
And if we go back to, as you say, the start of the printing press, first things being published were the Bible, the religious tracts. How did the printed word expand from that period in the 15th century to become effectively a, you know, pretty universal means of communication?
We always talk about Gutenberg's Bible, but he has a couple of test goes at printing. And one of the pamphlets that he produces is a pamphlet against the Turks, against the rise of the Ottoman Empire, who have just taken Constantinople. This is a great moment of crisis for Christendom, if you like. And both Gutenberg's Bible and his anti-Turkish pamphlet are sort of part of that world when Christianity is trying to flex itself. So it's more geopolitical, perhaps, than simply religious, even at the start. And those threads, the ability of the printing press to promulgate and spread information of all sorts, is actually a pretty steady march. And then we see associated technologies like the development of cheaper paper. The first printed paper is all made of linen rags, but then by the 19th century, we get wood pulp paper, which is much, much cheaper and easier to produce. So there's a big technological work to develop books into the objects that we all experience now. And alongside that, the realization that all kinds of material, sort of didactic and moral and teaching on the one hand, and then immediately satirical, transgressive, salacious material all can go through the printing press. And we see that within the first 30 or 40 years of Gutenberg's invention, pretty much the range of genres that are now printed are already available.
I mean, when they came out, books by, you know, Richardson or Fielding or whatever, big books like Tom Jones or Clarissa, how were people, when they were first published, consuming them? What were they getting? Were they getting bound volumes?
Samuel Richardson's a really interesting example because Richardson was also a printer. So he's printing his own works, and they are issued in serial form, not in the small sort of slightly newspapery serials we get a bit later with Dickens and so on. But they are first released in separate clutches of chapters. And one of the things we get with Richardson's books, Richardson publishes two really important novels about women's behaviour. One is Pamela, about a servant girl who keeps rejecting the advances of her predatory employer, and in fact she ends up marrying him. And Clarissa, who's a woman who's trying to retain her virtue. And one of the things about Richardson is he's in correspondence with quite a lot of his readers who write in to say, you know, what's going to happen next, and I hope you're, you know, not going to give this an unhappy ending. There are lots of particularly women readers of Richardson's novels who write alternatives as the serial is unfolding. They're early kinds of fan fiction in a way, which is a phenomenon we're much more used to as something online.
And so people were getting these books as pamphlets, and I suppose alongside, you've already mentioned them, pamphlets were being produced. The bound books, where do they fit in? Was that people, as it were, collecting pamphlets and then binding them themselves?
Yes. Most books are not sold as bound books with hard covers until probably the end of the 18th century. So if you went to buy a book before that period, what you bought was a pile of folded papers with a wrapper around them, and then you took them to the binder and you had them bound in your own library colours or according to the specification you wanted, cheaper, more expensive, more luxury, whatever. And certainly for some of those smaller, more ephemeral kinds of publication, like pamphlets or plays or something like that, you would gather together maybe 6 or 8 titles and get them bound up.
So the mass production of books, things with covers, when did that start?
Yeah, that's a 19th century thing, and that's about changes in the printing press, changes in the mechanisation of printing. So we tend to divide printing between what's called the hand press period, those kinds of machines where the paper is pressed down on a body of type and then a weight put on it to get the imprint, and then that weight is lifted and you take the paper out. That hand press period goes pretty much unchanged from the 15th to the beginning of the 19th century. And then we start to get, as we do in every industry, then mechanisation. And once you begin to develop a mechanised press, you can make the cover and the printed pages in the same process. And so completed books come off these production lines in a way that they hadn't done before.
And do you think that changed what was written, as it were, the types of books?
It's a really, really interesting question. I think the medium always does change the message, as Marshall McLuhan said decades ago. I think what's possible to do in a printed book changes because of the technology. So I think it probably does have an impact. But what we don't see until later in the 20th century probably is people writing for a really large public, anticipating a really large public. We don't see massive print runs until the 20th century.
Now, your exhibition, Sensational Books, you're actually really, I mean, sensation by definition, you're talking about or presenting, are you, the physicality of the book which you can hold and turn the pages of?
Yes, we're thinking about how books appeal to the senses beyond sight, and that's all the ways in which they are more than just a sort of invisible or transparent container for the words they have in them. They're objects with their own weight and their own sort of materiality in the world. So we're interested in smell, we're interested in taste. What happens if you literalize those ideas of being a bookworm, you know, that we consume our books? We're thinking about the kinds of physical dexterity books require. How did we learn to do page turning as opposed to scrolling? That's a new technical encounter with books. How do books sound? All of those elements that are often sort of we're not conscious of, but maybe it's, you're more conscious of them when they go a bit wrong or there's something a bit odd about it. You notice a book has a smell if you don't like the smell, but books do have a smell because of the materials they're made of or because of the places they've been stored.
And you've tracked down Tolkien's smell, is that right?
That's right. We had a great collaboration with the Institute for Digital Archaeology, who are inventive people thinking about how you make museum exhibitions more experiential, less sort of going along a load of glass cases and saying, oh, isn't that marvellous, and more a bit more immersive. And they extracted for us a range of scents from different books that we own in the Bodleian libraries. When they came with a proposal for this, they showed a video which included putting a book in a blender, but they were not allowed to do that. But they put books in these special sealed boxes to try and draw out what the smell was and then to reproduce that. So the Tolkien smell is a little bit of his pipe tobacco, a little bit leathery, a little bit dusty. It's quite a nostalgic smell. And we also had the smell of the Shakespeare First Folio and various other ones.
And how did the physicality of the book and the increasing relative affordability play into people beginning to assemble their own libraries?
That's a really interesting question. There's a very interesting moment in the development of America, the development of the American economy, that moment at the end of the 19th century when America becomes the dominant economic power, when what wealthy Americans do is buy up books. They buy up lots of English things, but they particularly buy books. And they establish book collecting as one of the keynotes of being a sophisticated person in the American Gilded Age. You have a big book collection. Book collection of that sort, of rare books, is not now so popular. We're not in a boom time for that. But what we are in a boom time for is people who own and enjoy curating their own libraries of perhaps books which are not particularly expensive, but which are meaningful and enjoyable to them. And also curating those to say something about themselves. We saw that a lot during lockdown, didn't we, when every pundit was interviewed in front of their bookshelf, and there was lots of analysis of what books they had there. The books that we have say something about us, and using a bookshelf to say something about your personality and your ambitions, I think, has become much more prominent in recent times.
As you say, these pundits and politicians had books behind them, yet we hear statistics saying the average household only has 3 books in it or something like that.
That's true, isn't it? I think books are very disproportionately distributed, that people who have books tend to have lots and tend to have, perhaps in many cases, more than they could ever read. That's an interesting phenomenon about book ownership, keeping hold of books that you know you probably are not going to read again, but nevertheless you don't want to get rid of. And yeah, the flip side of that is a huge number of households without books, a huge number of children who grow up without books, and of course a crisis in what the Victorians thought was the answer to that, which was the public lending library. And they invented that great system, and for various reasons we've seen it pretty much dismantled in our own time.
But is it possible that the screen could substitute for that, that we won't need books in future because we can get them on handheld devices? I mean, obviously Kindles, but laptops or tablets or whatever.
We've had a lot of predictions that e-books will take over from physical books, and that hasn't really happened yet. We've had a couple of high points in the sale of e-books, not surprisingly, during COVID, but there seems to be a bit of a ceiling on how many people want to access their books in that form. And correspondingly, I think book producers, the producers of physical books, have upped their game. Books are more beautiful and more enjoyable as objects now than they were even 10 years ago. I think there's a recognition that if you're going to buy a thing, you want it to be weighted properly. You want a nice cover. You want nice quality paper and so on. I think the big newcomer actually is audiobooks. I think that's one of the things that we did in the exhibition in the Bodleian was we had a survey. Are you an ebook person or a physical book person? And in the first week of the exhibition, everybody just wrote, I'm an audiobook person. So we made a third column, and the audio column has been the big surprise to me. I wonder if that's a little bit hidden, that people say, people still use the verb to read about something that they've heard, and maybe we're not noticing quite as much how many books now are consumed through the ear.
And of course, AI is now allowing mechanical means of people reading books. I mean, if you think of the New Yorker magazine or the Financial Times, if you go online, you can now press a button and a mechanical voice will read it to you.
Yeah, and I think that's great as the technology is now, isn't it? It's great for short articles. Probably a mechanical voice reading out a novel would pale after a while, but that will change, won't it? And I think listening to books, listening to consuming in that format while we're doing other things is probably one of the ways our relationship with books will change over the next decade or so.
You, however, do see a bit of a danger in the use of electronics to present books rather than the physical books. You've written that books could be cancelled as if they had never existed, which was barely possible in the era of print. What do you mean by that?
At the moment, most of the ebook providers don't actually sell you the ebook. They loan it to you on some basis or other, such that it can actually be withdrawn from your device without you knowing or without you acting on that. One of the interesting things that ebooks have done is they've tended to instigate a different model of ownership And one possible danger of that is that books could be withdrawn and a title could be withdrawn from everybody who had downloaded it in a way that a physical book, an issue of a physical book, is actually really hard to eliminate. Lots of people, lots of dictators, lots of crazy people of different sorts have tried to eradicate a book or a title or an author that they don't approve of, and they have almost never succeeded because the products of the printing press, the physical books, that portability that's so key to them means that they've already left the building. You know, you can't call them back.
So it plays to totalitarians, you know, got that science fiction book Fahrenheit 451, which is about destroying the book, but it's actually easier to do it online.
I think if your books are all digital, it's not difficult to withdraw access to them. If your books are physical, it's a lot more effort. Fahrenheit 451, which takes its title from the temperature that's needed to make a book incinerate, is all about the efforts that are gone to, isn't it? These crazy topsy-turvy firemen who go to make fires to destroy books. But it's an effort of work. These books keep re-emerging. It would be much easier if you were just able to press a button, I guess.
Do you think there is a threat to the physical book and indeed to libraries?
I don't see the threat to the physical book as imminent. The physical book itself is a technology which has been very resilient. It does lots of things very well. And at the moment, most of our ebook readers are really trying to be books, trying to be physical books. They're in the same format. They're roughly the same size. They try to offer some equivalent kind of reading experiences. What's interesting that hasn't happened is that we haven't had a whole range of sort of bells and whistles, multimedia books for e-readers. What people do with an e-reader is read the text pretty much as they would have done in a physical book. So I don't feel there's as much threat right now, but people who see children's reading and see children who are much, much more inclined to use a screen than a physical book might say otherwise.
Yeah, they sometimes see children pressing the picture in a book as if they expect it to do something. So finally, what is your favourite book?
I think if I were thinking about a book that I own that's important to me, I would probably choose a book that has some of my personal history in it. What's amazing to me about books is they're mass-produced items that we make personal. We make them into individual ones. And the one I would probably pick is a late 19th century collection of Shakespeare that my grandmother had as a school prize in Anglesey in Wales, and that was hanging around in her house, and which I was able to get rebound for her as a 80th birthday present. And then when she died, it came to me. So that's a book that means a lot to me. It's a good example for what I think is important about the book, that it's often not so much the contents as the associations and the witnesses and the journey of that book, how it means something to us as individuals.
Emma Smith of Hertford College, Oxford, with her choice of a favourite book. This is Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer was Murray Jessel, assistant producer Eve Webster, and sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Until the next time, thanks for listening.